conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster and welcome to the Green Majority. This week we have a whole bunch of Davids. First we have David Miller, former mayor of the City of Toronto, who's going to join us to talk a little bit about the Mayor's Tower Renewal Program. And I also ask him at the end just a little bit about, you know, shifting priorities and how projects can have vision through shifting administrations, through shifting public values, all that sorts of thing as well. So stay tuned for that. Of course, the former mayor is very well spoken, likes doing a lot of reaching out to the public, even since he's no longer the mayor, since he's stepped down. And great guy all around, I have to say. So stay tuned for that in the first half with Mayor's Tower Renewal and David Miller. Second half, we have another David Schindler, which is actually Dr. David Schindler. He's a well-known Canadian environmentalist, 40 years of plus experience with the environment in Canada as a scientist. And he's also he's coming to us today via Alternatives Journal. Thank you very much to them as well, once again, for the lead. But he had an article in the most recent episode of Alternatives Journal outlining kind of the history of the past 30-odd years of the Athabasca development in Alberta with the tar sands projects, and the science that was used to sort of justify policy and to outline policy, and the changing way in which politicians, both at the provincial in Alberta and federal level, have reacted to scientific input into the policymaking process. He starts off with his story many years ago, where the regulations were, you know, demonstrated to be inadequate to protect from monitoring toxins and stuff and whatnot leaking out, and then as they did better and better studies that showed that these monitoring were not as effective, the governments at the time were responsive and created new panels and this and that, and actually responded to the science. However, it's David Schindler's opinion that this is no longer the case, that science is no longer used to policy, but is instead pushed to the side. I think it's fair to say that he would say it's pushed to the side and been replaced by ideology and profit. So we'll hear from David Schindler in the second half. And then we're going to wrap up the program as a little bit more fun. Hopefully, we're going to be able to get her on the line. But former volunteer Naomi Jelikova, who's in BC now, former volunteer with the show, is off doing wonderful things in BC, is going to join us for a little chat about the environmental implications of Halloween, because we're getting close to that time of year as well. However, that is, without further ado, we're going to get the first David on the line. This is David Miller, former mayor of the City of Toronto with Mayor's Tower Renewal Program.
Today, I will be speaking to former mayor of the City of Toronto, David Miller, who is joining us today to talk about a program that he was very, very influential in getting going here, and I think is one of the hallmarks of his mayorship, which would be Mayor's Tower Renewal Program. Welcome to the Green Majority, David Miller.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be on. By way of background, at the city, we were very much interested in environmental opportunities, but we didn't just want to see them as environmental. We tried to find opportunities to lower our impact on the planet, to fight climate change, to help clean water, and to help make the city greener, that also had an impact positively on our economy and also had an impact on social justice and equality. So it's in that sort of context that Tower Renewal came about. Quite simply, Tower Renewal is about reskinning concrete apartment buildings built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So reskinning means you add a probably aluminum layer on the outside, and it allows you to insulate these buildings. And the reason that's important, and by the way, I should give credit where it's due, the work for this came from U of T, first of all from the engineering faculty, who were looking at environmental issues, how do we lower energy consumption, how do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and then from the architecture faculty, and then was brought to us. And when we reskin a building and insulate it, you can quite dramatically lower the energy consumption of these buildings. And that's important because in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the federal government, through the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, had a strategy to address housing needs by building concrete apartment buildings. And there's two qualities of these buildings. The concrete apartment buildings that we have all over Canada, there's about 1,000 in Toronto, there's many more across the country, will be here essentially forever. You know, they're made out of concrete. Their lifetime expected life is at least 100 years. It's probably much longer. They'll be here forever. That's the first quality. The second is that concrete has no insulating power, so they're terrible wasters of energy. A one-bedroom apartment, for example, uses more energy to heat and cool than a small house, which doesn't always make sense to people, but that's the fact. So what UofT determined was that if you put insulation on the outside of these buildings with an aluminum skin over it, you could reduce energy consumption by Toronto as a whole by about 5%. That's how wasteful these buildings are. And that would reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by an equivalent amount. So that's almost the first target from Kyoto, just by insulating these buildings. So that's fantastic on its own from an environmental perspective, but it's also important from an economic and social justice perspective, because many of these buildings are in lower income neighborhoods. They need renewal. There are opportunities for jobs for local people. We are working with the unions to train local people on the new skills so that people in a neighborhood would have a first chance at the jobs. And there were other aspects of it that helped renew neighborhoods. But it started with a very simple academic environmental idea. Let's reduce greenhouse gas emissions by insulating buildings in a very cost-effective way, about a 7 to 10 year payback. And then it moved into a way to rejuvenate neighborhoods. And I think that's why it's an exciting program, because it does both.
Mm-hmm. And so the original stakeholders here, obviously, you're talking about refurbishing and upgrading buildings to be more energy efficient, less waste. But just before we get onto the kind of specifics of beyond the actual cladding on the outside of the building, some of the other things that are being done here, who's the main stakeholder? Are these buildings are owned by the public? Are these private buildings and you're working with private owners?
Well, there's different stakeholders. I mean, first of all, many of the buildings are private. Some are public, owned by Toronto Community Housing Company, but the vast majority are private, and there are different kinds of landlords in Toronto. There are big national companies, there are medium-sized companies, and then there are people who might own one or two buildings. So you know, one of the things we tried to do with Tower Renewal was involve at the pilot stage all of those entities, big national companies, medium-sized companies, you know, family-owned businesses, and Toronto Community Housing. Landlords aren't the only stakeholder, of course, though. The people who live in the buildings are very important stakeholders as well. And one of the features of Mayor's Tower Renewal is a really extensive engagement program with the people who live in the building, because when you're renewing them, there are other things that you can do. For example, these buildings often have a lot of green space around them that's private green space, but perhaps might be underutilized. You know, maybe they built a pool with the buildings originally but can't afford to run it. And the people in the building might have some very specific ideas of what they want. You know, do they want a children's playground? Do they want the ground floor of the building to be rezoned commercial, because there's entrepreneurs in the building who want to create a business? Do they want the green space to be allowed to have a small urban farm or allotment gardens? You know, whatever, it's up to them. And so they're an important stakeholder as well, not just the owners, but also the residents.
Something we've covered on this program many, many times is there's certainly no lack of good environmental thinkers making good suggestions on a wide variety of issues. One of the things that when it comes down to that we found again and again that sort of slows down or stops this sort of idea, this sort of program that kind of improves efficiency or environmental initiatives of any kind, is that there's not an incentive for someone along the chain to do it, and therefore that unfortunately slows down or stops a lot of the progress that can be made. So the reason I was asking you about the sort of ownership and working with a variety of private owners is, what sort of ways have you found to, I mean, if it was in their financial interests on their own to do these sorts of things, you would imagine that they would have sort of done it without the government program or without, you know, Mayor's Tower Renewal program. So what sort of ways have you found to be able to work with private owners to encourage them to actually want to participate with these sorts of projects?
Yeah, the market will not do these projects on its own. And it's for a very simple reason. The projects are economic. The payback, depending on the price of energy, is between 7 and 10 years. But it's a really, that's a pretty quick payback for a building that's has a lifetime of 100 years. And the public sector is quite prepared to do it because of the way their finances work. It makes sense to spend some money, and for the next next 7 years, you're paying back your expense, and then for the 90 years after that, you're reducing costs. I mean, it's a very simple proposition for the public sector. Private sector, though, has a different economic equation. And for the kind of budgets that they use for this sort of work, private sector landlords want a 2 or 3 year payback. Maybe one who's really progressive and environmental would do it if there was a 4 year payback. But it's for reasons of interest cost, ease of security, all sorts of reasons. So the private sector won't do it on its own. The market doesn't create that outcome. So what we've tried to do by working, as I said, on I think it's 9 pilot sites, is work with the private sector as well as the tenants to create ways that it becomes economic for the private sector. And there are some things we know that would help. In Melbourne, Australia, they have a program. It's directed at commercial buildings, but they use a mechanism that would help here, which is the state there passed a regulation that allows, if you're doing an energy retrofit, the costs of the retrofit are repayable as if they were property taxes. So that means it's very simple from a paperwork perspective. And it's sort of like what they call in the States PACE bonds, although that in the end had some obstacles placed in its way. But it's a very simple idea and a simple way of mobilizing the capital to do it. So we asked the province of Ontario to pass that regulation. They haven't yet. But something like that will bring the private sector and the public sector together. There's a market imperfection here that doesn't allow for the savings payback to be fast enough for the private sector to do it. And what the city's trying to do through these pilot projects is find ways that they can make it very simple, and it can be replicated on hundreds and hundreds of buildings. If there's 1,000 of these buildings in Toronto, there's probably 4,000 across Canada. And so that creates a huge market for the technology needed, the skills, huge economic opportunities, obviously massive greenhouse gas reductions. And if we can create a model that's simple and can be replicated across all those buildings, we can make it happen.
How exportable, based on your experience, are these types of ideas? I mean, you were talking about some of the issues are with that the private sector system isn't set up to kind of mesh automatically, and so you had to create a program to kind of get private sector on board. Is this an issue that's Toronto-centric? Is this something that's easily exportable to the rest of the Canada or to the rest of the world?
The idea is very exportable. In every place, there'll be a local wrinkle that needs to get sorted out, but the idea is universal. And as chair of the C40 group of cities who are leading cities of the world, leading the fight against climate change, and we also add business missions to various cities. And it's called Mayor's Tower Renewal, not because David Miller brought it forward as mayor to the city of Toronto, because we want mayors of every city in the world to adopt this kind of idea. So we have a sister city relationship with Chongqing, China, which is a small city of about 35 million people. You know, it's a city the size of Canada. They have numerous concrete buildings. Their issues are a bit different than ours. It's more about heating than cooling, cooling than heating. But the same principle applies. And we brought the architects involved with this with us on the business mission. They gave a seminar in Chongqing to about 200 architects and engineers, and then were asked to do another one in Toronto, where Chongqing sent over about another, I think somewhere between 50 and 100 architects and engineers to Toronto to learn about tower renewal. So the idea makes sense anywhere concrete was used to build apartment buildings, and that was very typical in many cities in the world in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And there was a big push on for housing post-war. And the policies that supported the creation of these buildings, really the thinking was really started post-war. Now, in every jurisdiction, there's an issue about financing. And different places can have different solutions. But the program itself and the benefits of community engagement, of turning green space into something more useful to the community than underutilized passive green space, even creating a park is better than having a rusting chain link fence around an area that nobody uses. In fact, creating a park's fantastic. Maybe that's what you want to do. And rezoning the base of these buildings for commercial. All of those ideas are translatable everywhere. And I've had conversations with many mayors around the world. And in my role now as an advisor to the World Bank, the OECD, and others, the issue of buildings is forefront. And it's for a simple reason. If we want to overcome the challenges of climate change, the place we're going to win or lose that battle is in cities. Depending on whose figures you accept, up to 80% of the emissions can be credited to cities. And in most cities in the world, the majority of the emissions are to do with heating and cooling buildings. So by reducing the amount of energy buildings need, you're having a dramatic impact on greenhouse gas emissions and reducing them. And of course, all these energy retrofits are very labor intensive. So at a time people need jobs, it wins on both fronts. So there's huge interest around the world. And in the United States, I've been talking to a venture capital fund who are quite interested in funding this once they can figure out exactly how to make the model simple and easily replicated in different buildings. And that's the work that's going on now, including at the City of Toronto.
So one of the other, I think, obvious questions there as well is, you know, we've got so many existing buildings, obviously the massive cities all over the planet. Toronto specifically has, you know, lots of high rises and big buildings. And I mean, we were talking mostly residential buildings, but there's also all the condos more traditional residential buildings. And then downtown, we have the huge condo boom and all the office towers and everything. So, I mean, retrofitting what we have makes a lot of sense. And obviously then tearing it down and building a new one. But that is the other side of the coin, is there still is new buildings being built all the time, and they, you know, we're still kind of at the tail end of a condo boom here in the City of Toronto and in lots of places. How do you see any options for trying to solve the problem of building badly designed, from an environmental standpoint, badly designed buildings in the first place?
Well, the first point that people need to think about is most of the buildings that will be here in 50 years have already been built. So we really have to address old buildings. That's critical, and they're not going to move. And there are other opportunities. I won't get into the details for time, but when you reskin a building, you could run the pipes up for geothermal and run it down below ground. You could use solar panels to skin the building. There's all sorts of things you can do. You could put a green roof on and have a living wall, many, many different things. So that's what's exciting about the program, because you can really layer positive additional environmental steps and job creating steps on the same program. New buildings matter as well. They're just we have to address old ones. And the good thing about some cities like Toronto is we've recognized that we've got to find ways to fight sprawl. And people, I think, disagree in Toronto reasonably about whether, you know, tall downtown buildings are the right way to do that or not. But at a minimum, what this does is bring people into downtown where they can be close to where they work. And that matters because you get people out of cars, on foot. New buildings tend to be built to higher environmental standards. And the most recent buildings, in Toronto's case at least, have to be built to our green buildings bylaw, which was a standard we set that at its heart is really about the amount of energy that will be used in a building. So you have to design it to minimize the amount of energy. It's like the LEED standard, but it's more substantive because it also talks about, you know, how you're located in relation to transit and so forth. So new buildings are really important. The good news there is the smartest developers of both commercial and residential buildings are realizing that people are prepared to pay a premium to live in a green building for a whole bunch of reasons. People like the cleaner air. They like carpets that don't have noxious emissions. They want to do the right thing, and it gives them, you know, the ability, if they live in a state-of-the-art green building or work in one, to say, I've put my money where my beliefs are. So Tridel and Minto on the residential side and all the commercial developers in downtown Toronto are now building buildings that minimize energy consumption, and they're state-of-the-art. And that's good news. The better news is there are a lot of technologies coming that can take us even further. Phoenix Energy in Vancouver, for example, is using horizontal drilling techniques that actually come from the oil industry to drill underground between existing buildings and create geothermal loops. And if you have condominiums near commercial buildings, their heating and cooling load is different. You know, people get up in the morning and have a shower, and then all this hot water, there's all this energy in the hot water. If you tap that off and connect to a geothermal loop, and the commercial building is connected to that, people can literally use the heat from the hot, from the showers in the morning, the waste heat as the water runs down the drain, to heat the commercial building the rest of the day. And wow. These technologies are coming, and I'm actually quite bullish because those are market-based. Sometimes you need a little bit of a government subsidy here and there to get things going, and that's fine. I think that's exactly where the government should subsidize. But they are coming, and we can, I think, see a future fairly soon where we don't have to rely on electricity from a huge plant, you know, 100 miles away to heat and cool our buildings, that the vast majority of the heating and cooling can be done by mechanisms like that. You need a little bit of electricity to run the pumps, but much less than you electricity or gas that you need now to heat and cool buildings.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. You've been very generous with your time. I have one final question for you, which I'm not sure how much you're going to be able to answer it, which is why I left it for last. So you can kind of say what you will about this. But just in a very general sense, I'm not going to ask you to make any specific comments about the political status in Toronto. But just in a very general sense, I guess, for advice for maybe a future Toronto or future Canadian elsewhere in Canada mayor who maybe, you know, will be becoming mayor over the next few years or when they grow up, if they're younger now. When you have a situation where, I mean, something you'd be very familiar with your term, shall we say, shifting priorities, both in the public and now that you've left office with a new government in place, how do you, I guess, promote and talk about, and most importantly, what I'm interested in is how do you sustain these types of programs when both the public and following administrations may have a different set of priorities than you?
Well, I think you have to make it clear to the people of Toronto, you know, and I was very lucky. People were with me on these issues. In 2006, I ran very explicitly on a very strong environmental campaign platform, and I got 60% of the vote. And, you know, right till my final day as mayor, the work we were doing on environmental issues was massively popular, and people asked two things, for us to do more of it and for them to get personally involved. And the people will be behind you. And I think as an elected official, you can be brave. You know, sometimes on environmental issues, we have to say we've got to make an investment now. But over time, it always pays off. And it's for a very simple principle. What's bad for business is waste. What's bad for the environment is waste. And when you get rid of waste, it's good for the environment and good for the economy. And people understand that. They want to see the right thing done. But sometimes they're very busy. They're not experts. They don't know what the right thing is. And they look to elected officials who are in a leadership position to lead. And I don't think people should be afraid of leading. People will be behind you. They want to see things happen. And I certainly was very pleased in Toronto that we were able to make a whole range of initiatives happen. And, you know, one of the nice things in my life, I get thanked for them every day. So it's been a real privilege. And that's my advice. If you want to run for office, be true to yourself. Be brave and be clear about what you want to do. People will be with you. And when you get elected, make it happen.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite pundits said something along the lines of, if you don't find like you have the people behind you, don't lower your expectations, make a better case.
That's great advice, and in a quite long-winded way, that's what I was trying to say.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us, David Miller.
Pleasure being on the show. Bye-bye.
All right, so you're listening to The Green Majority. That, of course, was former mayor of the city of Toronto, David Miller, staunch environmentalist and an all-around nice guy. Met him a couple of times. We're going to have our international headlines in a sec. I just want to remind you, of course, that you are listening to The Green Majority. You can listen to us online if you don't have time to catch the show live on 89.5 FM, or if you happen to be listening to us in range of one of our syndicates, but you missed the show, you can always go to greenmajority.ca. All the episodes are posted up there. Now, we're also back with our website if you've been catching the show, but maybe you don't listen to every episode. We were having some website troubles. Our website is back up, still being worked on, still being tweaked, but definitely all the content that used to be up there is there, and we're going to continue adding. It's actually much shinier than it was before, so go and check it out if you haven't had a look yet. A couple of announcements about that as well. We have a new syndication list up there. If you've heard us on a radio station, though, it happens all the time. Where their people pick us up and they start playing our show, and we didn't actually realize it, which is great, but we love knowing about it. So if you happen to hear us anywhere, even on another website or anything like that, and it's not on that syndication page, fire us an email at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. Not even because we're going to say no. We love people playing our program. We just want to be able to give them credit and have it listed on the website, so that would be great. If there's a radio station near you that you think should be carrying our program, you think other people should hear it, by all means, either send us a notice or feel free. Radio stations, especially community radio stations, are very subject to, they're always looking for good spoken word content due to CRTC minimums. They have to play it. It's lots of time to produce, so why not give them a well-produced show that's already done that you think people should listen to? So if there's a local radio station that doesn't carry us, go ahead and send them an email or a call and say they should be carrying the Green Majority. They can contact us, or you can have us contact them. No problem. We always love your help getting the word out there as well. You can also check us out on Twitter, which aside from right now when she's sitting in the studio about to do the headlines, Leah's sitting in front of the computer now every episode, so you can interact with the show live if you have questions about any of our features. Even if it's a pre-record, we can always tweet back to you and answer questions, or if we don't have something, we can either deal with it on the following show or reply to you in an email later on. But particularly if we have live guests or if it's during any of our roundtable discussions, if you have anything you'd like to add, any 2 cents you want to throw in, go ahead and send us a message on Twitter as well. We'll respond to that. Of course, we always have our Facebook page and the Delicious feed, the Twitter feed, all sorts of things going on online. We're also carried, as I was mentioning before, on 17 campus and community stations coast to coast. We'd like that number to grow as often and frequently as possible, but that's currently from Vancouver, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland, so we do have national coverage. You can also listen live nationwide on channel 826 of the Shaw Direct Satellite Network or channel 946 of the Rogers Digital Channel platform. And of course, audio copies are now available once again on iTunes. I realized that iTunes was down for a little while. We've managed to fix that. It had to do with the website shift, so iTunes is now available as well. A million and one ways to carry and catch the Green Majority, as it should be. Now, however, we're going to take a quick pause, is what I was going for, as Leah Mazzolini now has some international headlines for us.
Thanks, Darren. According to new research, Earth's oceans may regain the same hi-fi sound qualities they had during the age of the dinosaurs due to rising global temperatures. The new study predicts that by the year 2100, climate change will acidify salt water sufficiently to make low-frequency sound near the ocean surface travel significantly farther than it does currently. Twice as far, actually. Rhode Island acoustician David G. Browning and lead scientist on the research team says that this is what they call the Cretaceous acoustic effect, given that the level of ocean acidification will mirror the same conditions 110 million years ago. This research also builds on the recent investigation by other researchers who analyzed historic levels on boron in seafloor sediments to reconstruct ocean acidity for the past 300 million years. If further work validates this model, future scuba divers might hear in the oceans with the same clarity as the dinosaurs. An environmental group's new report makes the case that the decision to allow fracking on Pennsylvania's campuses may be detrimental to the health of surrounding communities. Gas Patch Roulette, how shale gas development risks public health in Pennsylvania, was conducted by Earthworks between August 2011 and July 2012. Surveying 108 residents in 14 Pennsylvania counties, the report found that those living closer to gas facilities reported higher rates of symptoms of impaired health. When facilities were 1,500 to 4,000 feet away, 27% of participants reported throat irritation. This increased to 63% at 501 to 1,500 feet and 74% at less than 500 feet. The report also states more than half of the water well samples had elevated levels of methane, and some had iron, manganese, arsenic, and lead at levels higher than the maximum contaminant levels set by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. The European Union meeting ahead of next month's International Climate Summit ended without resolutions after coal-dependent Poland led opposition on Thursday, October 25th. There was a lot of discrepancy over a surplus of UN pollution permits, but the EU officials say that it had serious implications for UN efforts to tackle climate change. Europe has taken a leading role in the Kyoto process, the only international framework for tackling climate change, whose first phase expires at the end of this year. Many European nations say that the EU's environmental integrity would be undermined if it held on to an excess of allowances, known as assigned amount units, or AAUs. However, Poland has repeatedly opposed efforts to stop keeping its additional AAUs and garnered the support of other Eastern European and Baltic states at Thursday's meeting. EU officials referred to this as the East-West divide. Polish Environment Minister Marcin Korolek confirmed a text agreed on Thursday had merely repeated previous statements and effectively sidestepped the AAU question. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to hear from Dr. David Schindler. He's been an influential environmentalist in Canada for going on 40 years now. Very smart guy. He's got some choice words to say about a couple of topics, but most notably, he's been working on issues having to do with waterway pollution, specifically having to do with the tar sands in Alberta and the Athabasca River. And then we move on to talk a little bit about how scientific policy has been taken into context with the development of policy in Canada, both at a provincial and federal level, over the past 40 years, roughly. And basically what he's getting at was the fact that basically science used to be taken into account, and now it's kind of not. Anyway, we'll hear from him right after these music break. Don't go anywhere. It's very interesting.
You hear the one about the girl with the broken heart. Don't believe it for a second. She'll tell you about the star. She'll be right by your side in time. She'll be nowhere inside. The day you met her, like the rumble and the tumble as you love the stride. Did you know this game and all of the stakes? Cause she knows who she'll leave in her way. She'll always say hello. Don't you know? But as the
listening to Darren Kaster with the Green Majority, produced live at CIUT 89.5 here in Toronto every Friday morning. You can catch us online on iTunes, Twitter, Facebook, Delicious, YouTube. Am I missing anything? Everywhere. Basically, we're everywhere. We're going to go now to an interview I did yesterday, actually, with Dr. David Schindler, very influential Canadian scientist. He was the director of the Experimental Lakes Area Research Facility in Ontario from the late 60s until almost 1990. And he's been a leading Canadian scientist having to do with environmental issues for quite some time, in addition to being an officer of the Order of Canada recipient, many other awards, and is also a Killam Memorial Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. We go to Dr. David Schindler now to hear his commentary on the history of the science that's been history and of analysis of toxic pollutants in the Athabasca River waterways. And then second half of the interview, we talk about how science itself in general has been used to administer policy on the Canadian environment over the past 40 years. So take it away. This is me interviewing Dr. David Schindler.
The article itself begins by outlining sort of a timeline starting in 2008, having to do with the way that the federal government at the time was sort of responding to criticism about possible environmental complications for various waterways, including the Athabasca River, pollutants that were directly tied to oil and gas production. Can you just explain a little bit about what your concern was with the environmental effects from tar sands production and what the government's response at the time was?
All right. I think the problem really goes back to the provincial government of Alberta, which was putting out that the oil sands were not affecting the Athabasca River at all. And I did not feel that that could be correct. For one, they were not measuring the input of airborne pollutants into the river. In 1981 already, I had chaired a U.S. National Academy panel that examined the pollutant output from smelting and burning fossil fuels, and we did not find a single case where there was not airborne pollutants. And in the tar sands, they're smelting this bitumen, which has both organic and inorganic pollutants in large quantities. The industry was reporting that it had high emissions of things like mercury and arsenic and so on, but the government claimed that they weren't getting into the river. In fact, they weren't measuring them at all. And similarly, they claimed that digging up the watershed was putting nothing into the Athabasca River or its tributaries. Based on a program known as the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program, which was run by industry, and I knew that the RAMP program had had a scathing independent review in late 2004, and indeed after our 2008 study, it received yet another one from an independent group. So I challenged the claim that the tar sands were not polluting the river, the tar sands industry, that is, and the minister assured me that everything was just fine. So a group of us decided to mount our own study and to test the airborne pollutant hypothesis. We sampled snow at the end of winter when there would be about 4 months of accumulation of fallout in the snow, and found, as we expected, that there was considerable fallout of all of the pollutants that were in the tar sands, detectable out to a radius of 50 kilometers. And similarly, we looked at the pollutants in the river, both in late winter and again in midsummer, and found that pollutants were always higher downstream of industry, they were higher downstream of the industry than they were downstream of natural formations, which is what the industries and government wanted people to believe, that it was all natural. And we published those results in two papers in the Proceedings of the U.S. National Academy, which is a journal that takes good color images, which made it a convenient place to publish. And the first thing that happened was denial by both the provincial and federal ministers of environment. Fortunately, the federal minister had second thoughts and decided to fly out to Edmonton for a personal briefing. And after we went through and discussed our results with him, he was obviously fairly convinced and said, "What should I do?" And I said, "Well, rather than let this all be my opinion or my group's opinion versus the rest, why don't you put it out to an eminent group of scientists for review?" So he formed a panel of members of the Royal Society, ranging from ecologists to petroleum geologists, gave them 2 months. And they came back and said, yes, indeed, we were right that the monitoring program that they had been relying on was fatally flawed, and that our results indicated that it needed a great improvement. Shortly after he had formed his panel, the province formed their own panel, equally good experts. They gave them 4 months instead of two and gave them the task of comparing our data directly to the government's. And again, they found the government's data were wanting. In one case, they told them that a report that they kept pointing to had never been properly designed to measure the impact of the industry on the Athabasca River. And again, they said that we had uncovered some very important deficiencies in the program that needed correcting. So that was the situation as of early 2011. At that point, the then minister said, well, it's obvious we need some change. I'll appoint a panel of experts to help design a world-class monitoring program. So he did, and they reported in July. That panel was about half scientists and about half business people, but their report surprised the minister, I think, in that it said that a new monitoring program should be run by a panel of independent experts, not by either level of government, because both federal and provincial levels of government had lost the public trust. And the minister promised to act on that, but then we had an election. We got a new premier. The previous minister lost his job. It took a while for the new minister to learn her portfolio. But in February, after meeting with myself and also some of the people who were on that world-class monitoring panel, she appointed a panel to help flesh out what she had been told by the world-class monitoring program. They reported the end of June of this year. The minister finally acted on it about a week ago, and reportedly she had a tremendous fight to sell it to her caucus, but a week ago she announced that it would be independent, appointed some people to the initial board of it, with the mandate to make recommendations on funding it and on scientific oversight for the panel and on Aboriginal input to the panel. So that's where it stands right now. That recently appointed panel has indicated that they're going to act very rapidly. So perhaps now, going on 4 years after our studies were done, we have a glimmer of hope that perhaps we'll have a monitoring program for the Athabasca that could actually detect what's going on.
And now that's that gives us a fairly good story of sort of the last several years, and especially during rapid expansion in the Alberta tar sands sort of project. It brings up a wide number of questions here. I'm not entirely sure where to start. I think the place that I'd like to start, however, though, is, I mean, you, among other things, have been quite an outspoken for a scientist, the kind of original science activist and a personal hero of mine, Carl Sagan. One of the things that he experienced, and something that I've seen many other scientists, you're certainly not the only scientist or group of scientists that have been looking at health and environmental effects from Alberta energy projects, has been that under a number of cases, their work has been attacked. There have been direct personal attacks against scientists who have spoken out. What has been your experience just having been an outspoken scientist and this sort of fight to even get, you know, like you outlined in the article a number of times how, you know, there the studies that were in place or the checks that were in place were not valid, and if someone with knowledge had sort of gone over them or designed them, that they, you know, they wouldn't have obviously had these flaws. Just about the genuine attitude of either the federal or the provincial government to even have science involved at all in the decision-making process.
I came here from the U.S. Originally in the 1960s, because Canada was a world leader in that sort of thing. And the governments of the day, if they saw something that was going wrong environmentally, they wanted to fix it. They, in the 60s, put together a number of new big scientific institutions. I found that in those days, if you did the science to recommend a fix, politicians received it gladly and passed the necessary policy to see that it happened. The best example being controls on nutrients that caused eutrophication, the algal blooms on lakes. And we were able to fix Lakes Erie in Ontario and a lot of smaller lakes in Canada, and those policies were copied around the world. But things slowly deteriorated. In the days of acid rain, at first there was denial that acid rain happened. In one case, I was accused of inventing the problem to keep my project alive. But events went on, largely in the U.S. and Scandinavia, that showed that it was indeed a problem. Industry, once they saw the handwriting on the wall, reacted very rapidly. And government did their best to keep up. The government requirements were always running a little bit behind industry's cuts in that case, which was rather amusing, but still the reaction was pretty rapid, and we had the most stringent acid rain policies anywhere in the world in very short order. After that, things started to run down. Department of Fisheries and Department of Environment, every time there was a budget shortfall, which was frequent, their resources were cut. And salaries fell behind universities so that they weren't able to recruit the best scientists generally, though there were a few exceptions. And things deteriorated over the years, reaching their worst at the present when the few remaining good scientists are totally muzzled. They're not allowed to speak out on matters that they know about. Everything is directed through political spin doctors who, in general, know nothing about anything and are inclined to put out press releases that are meaningless, that contain no real information. And in a so-called democracy, and having been taught that a functional democracy depends on its citizens getting accurate information, I just find the whole situation right now to be detestable.
So what is it, David, what is your sort of opinion or on the effect that's had? I mean, you cited acid rain there. Another example would be ozone depleting aerosols and that type of thing, where there has been a initially doubted or initially not taken seriously, but then later, you know, demonstrated to be true and taken very seriously environmental concern in Canada and all over the world. Where these issues have been dealt with, and now it seems like more recently, very similar situations having to do with various forms of pollutants from the actual mining of carbon products or climate change or any one of these other issues, there doesn't seem to be that reaction. It seems to be that the reaction is to sort of ignore the science or silence the scientists. What, in your opinion, is the difference? Where have we had this change in effect? Is this a pure cost issue, or why do you think this has happened?
We've come more and more to have politicians who worship one god, economy. And in their view, anything else is expendable as long as economy is happy. The problem is nobody knows what makes economy is happy. So we sacrifice one thing and then we sacrifice something else, all to try and make economy happy. In fact, I think John Kenneth Galbraith had it right. Economy as a science makes astrology look pretty respectable. So we're really sacrificing a lot of things that Canadians, and not only Canadians, but world citizens, view as important in order to keep economy perking along, or trying to keep it perking along, though to me it looks very much like it's on permanent life support.
There's so much that we could talk about on these issues, but very, thank you so much for joining us today, David. I know you've got a plane to hop on. Just, I've got one final question for you. Looking forward now from this place, you've got over, you know, more than 40 years experience working in Canada. It's pretty much all your life as a scientist. Do you have any words of wisdom for scientists in Canada who are concerned with the environment, but are maybe, you know, doubtful? Maybe they're students who are not even sure they want to get into the sciences because, you know, they sort of see potentially the only place to get a good job where they can do anything is to go and work for the oil industry or go and work for, you know, research and development for a manufacturer, but not really doing, you know, the sort of research that helps us make good choices about policy or interest-based sciences, sort of directionless science, where we've gotten many of the major advances of the modern age, you know, who maybe you're considering, you know, maybe either brain drain and, you know, getting pulled down to the U.S. to do research or over to Europe to do research, or maybe considering avoiding science altogether because of this almost a sort of attack on the scientific point of view at all, as if it was just one way of looking at things. Do you have any words of wisdom or encouragement or perhaps resignation on that issue before we go?
I would say that science is going to come back. We're in about to the same period in environmental science right now as physics was in the McCarthy era in the U.S. And I hope it'll pass very quickly. I think as a society will realize within a few years that environmental scientists have been right. Right now we seem to have the kinds of doubt that the tobacco industry created about cigarette smoking in the 60s and 70s, but science always prevails. We not only need scientists, we need other educated people. We need a new economics. It's clear the economics cannot continue to be the economics of growth when science shows us that we're already beyond the Earth's carrying capacity. And even countries like Canada, which is a country, is not, look like they want to move in that same direction by emulating their heroes, the U.S. and China. We need some big social changes as well, and ethical changes. There's going to be a huge debate about how we get the population back in sync with the Earth's resources. And it isn't going to be through continued economic growth. It isn't going to be through simply adopting renewable energy sources, because I don't know of a renewable energy source that does not require fossil fuels to build it and operate it. So we're going to have to look for other things that make us happy besides a pile of little rectangles with dead politicians' faces on them. And we're going to have to go through some very rough times. But the alternative is that we as a society show no more sense than a population of fruit flies.
Perhaps a place to leave it off then is promoting a scientific literacy, not even necessarily in the sense of educating people in science, but perhaps we're so far gone at this point that even just a campaign to get people to sort of be scientifically literate enough to know when points of view that are being presented in the media or by politicians is even supported by facts or not, and that those facts matter, and that those generally more often than not, those facts come from scientists, and that we need to respect and revere our scientists, not, you know, shun them when they don't agree with our personal pet issues.
I think that's very well put.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, that was David Schindler. Among many other things, 40 years of environmental science under his belt, officer of the Order of Canada, recipient of many awards, and now a Killam Memorial Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
You're welcome.
All right. And of course, that was, as we were just saying there, Dr. David Schindler. Thank you so much to our guests today, both Dr. David Miller, not quite, former Mayor David Miller and Dr. David Schindler were very generous with their time this week. And also thank you very much to Alternatives Journal, as usual, for helping us out there and sort of giving us a lead on some contact there. Alternatives Journal is a great magazine as well, so go ahead and check them out. But not after you go and check out our new website, which is back up if you haven't looked at it yet, at greenmajority.ca. And now, quickly, with our last like kind of 30 seconds, Leah has a bit of an update actually about that story, which you would already know about if you were on our Twitter feed. But for those of you who aren't, well, you're going and adding yourselves to our Twitter feed at Green Majority. Leah, what is the update on that story?
Well, on Monday, October 22nd, there was a mass sit-in in front of the BC legislature in Victoria in protest of the Northern Gateway pipeline proposal. And there was 3,500 people there, and they were all willing to lay down in front of the bulldozer if indeed the pipeline is approved. So that's pretty substantial, because it's not been since a little time ago that 5,000 people were there in protest for striking for teachers. But in this case, this is the second highest number of people for a turnout for a protest in front of the BC legislature. So that's pretty substantial.
So big turnout is a key feature there. And the other key feature, I guess, is that it was entirely peaceful.
Yes, it was entirely peaceful. Nothing arose that was to be mentioned. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So no undercover police officers. I mean, Black Bloc. I mean, never mind. We'll talk about that on a different show. That's all the time we have for today. Technical production today was by Michael McDougall. Thank you very much. Web hosting and bandwidth for our podcast provided by the web consulting firm rjgcreative.com, with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program or transcript of some of the news headlines, actually in story form rather, at greenmajority.ca. If you have an idea for a topic or issue that you care about, would love to learn more about. Perhaps you know a stupendous environmental thinker like some of today's guests. We're fantastic. If you know more people like that, go ahead and send us an email, thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We love hearing from our listeners. You can also provide feedback on our fact page. You can fill out some of our surveys. You can look at our syndication, all sorts of fun things through the website, Facebook, Twitter, and others. I'm Darren Kaster. That's it all for all the time we have for today. Thanks for listening to today's live edition of The Green Majority. Until next week, we'll see you then.